There was a lot of acrimony about this whole subject because, as you can understand, and I bring it up because it did affect the Jewish community, the Jewish hospital, the Jewish neurosurgeon. These were all issues that people were sensitive about or were being highly criticized in the press. David Kostoff was being interviewed about this operation. There was a book written on the subject, and it was called The Dark Side of the House. Unfortunately, the book did not get much publicity, and not much was said or done about it, but in my judgment, it was an absolutely fascinating story from beginning to end, the story of the history of this Willard Wright, how it came that he was being sentenced, and he said to the judge, "I can't help myself, Judge, and what can I do? I don't want to rob, and I don't want to hurt anybody." And Willard Wright had a terrible background. He had a father that beat him, and it was a very tragic story. He was a very sensitive judge. Listened to his story, and Willard Wright said, "Judge, give me a chance." He said, "I'll do anything. I'll even have a lobotomy if it'll change." And the judge is the one that contacted David Kostoff. So it's a very fascinating story, and a story with many, many emotional aspects to it, as well as sentimental. But nonetheless, this was part of my time at Montefiore Hospital, and part of the reason I became interested in neurosurgery, and David Kostoff was a major influence. While I was then a resident at Montefiore, David Kostoff became, as I discussed earlier, was the head of the hospital from a medical point of view, the medical director, and we started, under his direction, a research department. We were the only clinical hospital, not university hospital, that had a private research department. And I had a lot of experience not only helping to run that, but also in doing research experiments. I think I mentioned earlier that we had a primate lab, in other words, a monkey lab, and I was able to do primary research on monkeys. So it did a great deal for my educational development in my field. I finished at the Montefiore Hospital in 1955. My residency program was 2 years. And I then obtained a residency at the Neurological Institute of New York, which gave me the opportunity to live in New York, which I had always wanted to do. And I found that most also educational experience that I, besides medicine and learning about New York and theater and music and so forth. At any rate, I not married at the time. I had, as I mentioned earlier, I was divorced. I lived at the hospital, and therefore was able to work day and night. And that gave me a great opportunity also, and not being tied down, to be able to study constantly and work. And the experience at Neurological Institute had its unique aspects. Neurological Institute at that time was considered a top training post in the country in neurosurgery. There were on the staff at that time 10 neurosurgeons and about 20 neurologists, so it was quite a diversified and very important experience. The chief of neurology was a man by the name of Houston Merritt, who was world famous in neurology and written several books, and the chief of neurosurgery was a fellow by the name of Larry Poole. He had just become the chief and had to replace a fellow by the name of Byron Stuckey. I mention their names because they played a role in New York in those years, which was interesting because when I became a resident at the Neurological Institute, the situation was such that everybody assumed that I was not Jewish. I mean, all Jews who knew anything about neurological institute or Presbyterian hospital assumed that anybody who trained there could not be Jewish because they didn't take Jews. However, that changed. It changed under my, I think a couple of years before me, there was a Jewish fellow who became a resident and one of their better and well-known residents, and his name, and he and I later became associated. His name is Charlie Carton. But that was a rarity, and it was just generally accepted. This was an attitude that prevailed. If you were Presbyterian, or you weren't Jewish, and if you were Jewish, you went to a Jewish hospital. In New York, certainly, there were plenty of Jewish hospitals. Beth Israel, Mount Sinai, Montefiore, so forth. But there was a lot to support that. Prior to my going to Neurological Institute, there was a famous Jewish neurosurgeon by the name of Leo Davidoff, who had been on the staff. And Dr. Davidoff had written many books. He was one of the movers, shakers and movers in the field of neurosurgery. And he, however, was not head of the department at the Neurological Institute. The head of the department was Byron Stuckey. Byron Stuckey, on the other hand, was an extremely influential man in the field of medicine, but not only in the field of medicine. His wife was a daughter of the famous financier Morgan, J.P. Morgan. That's right. How did you know? J.P. Morgan, so that he had tremendous influence on the board. And he, Davidoff left before I came and went to Montefiore Hospital, where I later encountered him and we'll discuss that in the, later. But the reason that he left is because he and Stuckey could not get along. Let's put it this way, Stuckey could not tolerate Davidoff. It's not hard to understand. Davidoff was not easy to get along with. Davidoff was a Polish orphan who was brought up, a Polish Jewish orphan who was brought up by an adopted father in this country, brought to this country, and Davidoff became one of the most famous Jewish doctors this country has ever known. He was one of the first. We always said he was the first Jewish neurosurgeon in the Jewish city of New York. And, however, he was a rather obstinate type. He was intense, he was severe, he didn't have much tolerance for people. But he became very famous, and being the only neurosurgeon at that time, and there weren't very many, certainly there were no other Jewish neurosurgeons around the country, because it was strictly a right Anglo-Saxon field. So started with Cushing in Boston, and they were very particular about who got into the field. It was a very limited field. But nonetheless, he left Presbyterian Hospital, Neurological Institute, and went to Montefiore Hospital. And the reason he did, and this I know is a fact, was told to me by a member of the board, that at one meeting, Byron Stuckey appeared and said to the board, either that Jew leaves or I leave. Now, this is the kind of thing that I don't think would go on today, but certainly did go on in those days. Davidoff left and went to started his own service, first at he was first at Mount Sinai, and then he later went to Montefiore, developed his own training program, started training Jewish residents in neurosurgery, and I later ended up exposed to him for a couple of years. But in my years at the Neurological Institute, I found it extremely present, a wonderful working environment, except there was a somewhat different attitude than I had been exposed to. And that attitude was that you didn't think about the mind. You didn't think about the feelings. you thought only scientifically or academically about a patient. A couple examples. I remember one of the early cases that I examined as a resident, the attending physician's name was Fritz Kramer, and he read my note, and I had written in the note that I suspected that this patient really had a form of atypical neuralgia and was not a surgical candidate for that reason. And he called me and he said, and he went over my note, and I think it was the first week I was there, and he said, Dr. Kessler, you better learn something fast. You're not here for your psychiatric opinion. You're here for your neurological opinion. So that sort of set me straight. But one other time, I had a wonderful experience along similar lines, when there was a woman that I happened to stumble across in one of the general wards. In those days, we had big wards. But she was not in the neurological institute section. She was in the general Presbyterian section. But one of the residents told me about her at lunch that I knew. And I said, why don't you put a consultation and let me examine her? It turned out it was a Jewish lady who got into the Presbyterian hospital who couldn't speak English very well. And she was complaining, and they didn't know what she was complaining about. And it was interesting to me that she had been in and out. Those days you could be in the hospital for weeks, you know, nothing ever happened, nobody had told you to leave, you just, if you were complaining, they didn't know what else to do, and you were there, and they'd run a few tests. We didn't have so many tests in those days, but nothing much happened to this lady after a few days. And I couldn't understand that, because when I talked to her after a short period of time, she had a classical syndrome called trigeminal neuralgia. And it was very interesting, because all she kept saying, stupid face, stupid face. And she couldn't explain to her that, well, finally she got a Jewish doctor who understood a little bit the type characteristic of the pain, exact location of the pain, and we were able to treat her. But these are the kinds of things that separated the Jewish world from the Gentile world in those days, and they were real, but they were changing. The fact that I was there and able to have some role did mean that they were changing. I spent 3 years at the Neurological Institute and finished as a senior resident and was able therefore to become eligible with that training to become a board-certified neurosurgeon. However, I was not at that point thinking about coming back to Pittsburgh. I had met my wife and married in my last year of residency, and though we had talked a great deal about coming back to Pittsburgh, I felt that I wanted to go on to do some other things in New York. So, the first thing I wanted to do was spend time under the supervision and exposure of a man by the name of James Pappin at the Lady Clinic, who was then considered by those who knew him to be the greatest neurosurgeon in the world. And that, to my experience, he was. And I was fortunate to be given a six-month fellowship that allowed me to assist him at surgery at the Leahy Clinic in Boston. I found him a most engaging and enchanting man. He was a big fellow. He was the kind of surgeon that didn't matter what he did. If he opened the chest to get to a nerve in the chest, or opened the belly to get to a particular nerve in the belly, the respective surgical specialties came to watch him do that. The belly surgeons came to watch him do it, and so on and so forth. Neurosurgeons came from all over the country. And all over the world to watch him. However, in certain quarters, politics always plays a role. He was not thought well of because he became the physician for, became the neurosurgeon for Peron. And because he was fluent in Argentina, because they had asked him to come there to see Peron, he was thought of in certain circles, in certain liberal circles, as being fascist, but he certainly was not. And he was just a great neurosurgeon who couldn't care less about politics. He was a big, big man, and a man of few words. But he had been, prior to his medical experiences, prior to going to medical school, he had been a pitcher for the Baltimore Orioles. And he was referred to during those years as Big Jim. He actually came to work in the clinic, at the Lady Clinic in 1933. And that was the retirement year of Harvey Cushing. Harvey Cushing was the father of neurosurgery. So it was a great thrill for me to be given this opportunity to work with such a man. The man who actually replaced Harvey Cushing, however, was a man by the name of Gilbert Borax. Gilbert Borax was a bright, bright man, but not much of a surgeon. If anybody who listens to this tape must be aware that there are good thinkers and there are good surgeons, and sometimes Mr. Couche is never the train shall meet. But nonetheless, Gilbert Borax was a great writer, a great thinker, a great theorist. But he never, as Papen once told me, he never, ever could complete a major operation on his own. Gilbert Horrocks had been the associate of Harvey Cushing during most of Harvey Cushing's actual practice, and he would assist him. And Harvey Cushing never let him do anything except open and close the wound. He never actually had responsibility. So when the responsibility finally came to him after Harvey Cushing's retirement, he really couldn't handle it. And Jim Papen told me that he never, ever got to finish a golf game, because every time he would be in the middle of the golf course, he'd get a call from the Lady Clinic saying, Dr. Horrax would like you to come back to the clinic. So I find those stories interesting.
What is the Horrax?
H-O-R-R-A-X.
I found
that fascinating, because this was really the fundamental history of neurosurgery. These were the people who started neurosurgery, at least in this country, and I was right in the middle of that. But most interesting to me of talking about Papen is not only watching him work, he had tremendous skill. He figured out every operation. Planned the operation in detail. He knew exactly what was going to happen next. He never was frustrated by anything that went slightly awry. He immediately corrected it. He had little tricks that made what he did seem so much easier than what other men did. And it was interesting to me to be able to combine those teachings that he gave me with what I had learned among the other exposures that I had in neurosurgery. But most important, I asked him about how it felt to become the successor to the patients and to the practice of a man as famous as Harvey Cushing. I mentioned Harvey Cushing on this tape, and for you people listening, as though everybody knows who Harvey Cushing was. No, I assume people don't. I know that even many of my young colleagues don't know who Harvey Cushing was. But Harvey Cushing was the man who developed neurosurgery in this country. Famous world over, Harvey Cushing, it is said that he, for all the years that he practiced, if all of his writings were divided up by the day, he would have had to have written 10 pages of technical literature per day of every day of his practice. Now, anybody who writes papers, scientific papers today, and be aware of what a tremendous ordeal this would have to be, an effort and work and concept to produce that much worthwhile literature, which remains solid today. But nonetheless, I said, how does it feel, Dr. Papen, to have succeeded? So he would tell me stories that when he first came to the clinic as a new young neurosurgeon, Harvey Cushing would sit behind him on a big stool and watch him. And I said, didn't that make you nervous as a young man? He says, well, yes, he said, it did upset me a little bit. And I said, well, what would Dr. Cushing say to you? Well, he would make suggestions. Jim, why don't you do this? Jim, why don't you do that? He says, until finally one day, I had enough of that. And I turned around and I said, Dr. Cushing, would you like to do this operation? And Dr. Cushing says, oh, no, Jim, you go right ahead. He never said a word after that. But I have to laugh because Jim Poppin, I'm sure, never was unnerved. Anybody can be a pitcher for the Baltimore Orioles is not unnerved by this great operation, in my judgment. Well, I finished my time in Boston, which, by the way, my wife, my young wife, who was just married a short time, was with me. She loved Boston, probably surprisingly so, because as a New Yorker, most New Yorkers don't like any place else as well as they do in fact. She did love Boston. It was from Boston that we then left for what I considered to be my first job at earning money. You must be aware that all of this time, which encompassed the years 1951, when I went into the military service, until 1959, until I finished at the Lady Clinic, I didn't earn any money. Small stipends you would get. I remember as an intern, about $25 a month, and then eventually when I was a senior resident at New Life Institute, I think we got paid $100 a month during the Leahy Clinic. That was a fellowship that, as I recall, didn't pay anything. And I wonder how we lived in those days. Well, we didn't need much money. My wife, that was my work. Prior to that, I lived at the hospital. I did have money that I saved from the military service. It's amazing how much better one could get along in those days with very little money or practically no money. But nonetheless, I finally got a job, and this was in Dallas, Texas. They had just started a new medical school there, and a friend of mine who had been ahead of me at the Neurological Institute called me and asked me to come down and join him in practice. He became the head of neurosurgery at what was called Southwestern Medical School, and he offered me an appointment at the medical school. That was in 1959, and my wife and I drove to Dallas from New York. My wife was pregnant with our first child at the time. We drove, taking several days to get there. I remember when we arrived in Dallas, we were received very nicely. Everybody could not have been nicer, but I was, again, surprised, naive, and amazed. That attitude was not exactly as I had known them to be in New York and Boston. I mean, I'm talking about intellectual and academic attitudes. Being that I had come there as a new professor, I was invited to address the senior class of the medical school. And I remember when I did, I'm not a bad lecturer, I think I'm a pretty good lecturer, but I remember prepared to give a lecture on a subject which was new to medicine and neurosurgery at that time, and that's cerebral vascular surgery. In other words, the operation on the brain for blood vessel diseases such as AV malformations and aneurysms and strokes. And that was fairly new at that time. So that it seemed to me that people ought to be interested in this subject as the seniors in medical school. So it was interesting to me that after I completed, everybody was very courteous and everybody listened. There were a few people nodding off, as always is the case when you lecture to students who don't get enough sleep. But nonetheless, when the lecture was over, everybody politely got up and walked out of the room. Not one question was asked of me, and not one comment. And this was my first rather startling experience. And I had something to compare against, because in Boston, I was asked to give lectures, whereas all the younger so-called PhD students or residency students do, because the attending the senior men are too busy to do it. In New York, I certainly did a lot of this as senior resident. We not only have medical students, selected students, but nurses and younger residents and interns and so forth. So that there's always this spirit, this experience of giving lectures is part of your training, part of your experience, and part of your education. And in New York, I remember talking to medical students, my God, they didn't let you learn. I mean, if you said ah, they said, no, you should have said A. And if you said B, they should have said, you're a doctor, isn't it C? And everybody knew the literature and the criticism was unlimited. I got to Dallas, Texas, it was not a question. So I realized it was a different world, a different environment. The next experience I had, they had saved a particular case for me to do. It was a case of an aneurysm. An aneurysm is a swelling of a blood vessel in the brain that had ruptured. And in those days, not many such cases were being operated on except in major medical centers. And since this was my interest and I had a lot of exposure and training in this field, the chief who invited me down to Dallas to work had saved this case for me to operate upon. Again, you would think that the house staff, the residents, although it wasn't under a surgical residency, they were general surgical residents, but they were two young men assigned to assist me in this operation. Fortunately, the head nurse had been formerly a head nurse in New York at the Neurological Institute. And she knew me, and she certainly knew the operation and knew how to set up the case. So this part of the trauma of that was not my concern. But here were these two doctors, young doctors who were assigned to be my assistants, and I remember so well, they were just as the newspaper or movies would have predicted they should be, because they were Texans from Dallas. They were tall, muscular, blonde, and totally disinterested in education. Their interests seemed to be, to me, a new gun that one had just put acquired. Now, if you can imagine coming out of the New York, Boston environment, educational environment at Harvard and at Columbia, and then coming to the Dallas Medical School, where the major interest was a gun and not the patient or the operation, it was again another shock to my system. It was not an easy transition. I could see what was developing. The operation went okay. That was not a big problem, and they certainly were good assistants from that point of view, but not much interest in the academics of what was happening. At any rate, in the meantime, my dear, wonderful wife was young and a New Yorker, who had not been further than the Hudson River, didn't know that any such, that the country was even settled beyond the Hudson River. And she was all day we were living in a motel. When you're young, you don't really give much thought to what other, you take a lot for granted and think everybody's okay and doing well. And I wasn't quite aware of how difficult it was to get better. And for me, of course, I was involved. The chief was my friend. We were very good friends in New York. I felt quite at home with him. But I found that he was the chief at the medical school, which encompassed the South, it's called Southwestern Medical School, and now I can't think of it, encompassed the name of the hospital in Wilford. But they were not paying my salary. They would pay me a stipend, but I really had to go into private practice to earn money. The medical school could not afford to carry two neurosurgeons at that time. So he took me around and introduced me to other doctors in the community. And again, I was shocked because... because I found that everybody I met was not interested in my education, not interested in my abilities or my talents, but was interested in which country club I was going to join, and whether I played golf, and obviously what my religion was, and what I had to do to get referrals and make a living socially in Dallas, Texas. And I realized that it was going to be very difficult for me because I was not going to make serious compromises along social lines. I